You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Sunday, September 3rd, and we are live from DragonCon. This is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein. And our special guest for this episode, Brian Brushwood.
Oh, I'm so sweaty.
You are.
I was running.
Yeah, well, some of us chose the sweaty costumes. So we loved our Dragon Con episode every year. We have so much fun while we're here. This year we were trying to decide what to do for our costume. If you remember last year, our group costume was Star Trek, the original series. We were all in costume, including Brian.
Yeah,
it was a lot of fun.
So, for the record, that got my vote to do that again this year, but you thought that was lame.
Yeah, it was, because they didn't want to repeat the same exact thing we did last year.
They were awesome costumes. All right, never mind.
Yeah. So, as you could see, we couldn't agree on a group costume this year.
What are you talking about?
I think there's a unified theme here.
No, there's a theme, but you can't know what it is until I tell you. So we decided what we would do is we would each buy our own costumes at the con. So we came with no costume for the show. And we had a budget. We all had the same budget. So, okay, do whatever you want to do for $100. We'll see what you can put together for a costume.
But clearly, some people exceeded that budget.
Well, just clearly.
And it's not me.
It was more of a guideline than a rule.
Except some of us were not informed that it was more of a guideline.
So if I saw stuff, I'm like, okay, I want that. How much is that? $350. Damn. All right, that's awesome. How much is that? $500. Like,
you're going in the wrong direction.
But that's the point. We know what it costs to costume a dragon. It's not inexpensive. That's the whole point, is to make it more difficult, make it more challenging. And that was part of the fun.
Yeah.
It was for me.
All right, so we're each going to tell you the process we went through to get our costume and what it cost. So I'll go first. And by the way, it was okay to use things that you already had. So I just happened to have a lightsaber. So I built my costume around a lightsaber. Right, okay. So I figured that I wanted to... I didn't want to waste $100 on a one-off costume, right? So I'm like, all right, what do I want to have in my repertoire? I don't have a good Jedi costume. So I'm like, all right, I'll just spend $100 on a good piece, a good Jedi robe, you know, something that I could use as the centerpiece for my Jedi costume, even though it's kind of not that imaginative. I don't care. That's what I wanted to have in my costume. I couldn't find one. I could not find, like, a really good Jedi robe at the con. I was shocked. But then I came across a booth selling Japanese clothing, you know, kimonos.
Kimonos, yeah.
Yeah, they both men and women. And then I realized, in a brilliant stroke, I said, hey, the Jedi are pretty much based on the samurai. So I figured I would do a samurai Jedi, right? Samurai robes basically are Jedi robes. So that's what I did. Now, in terms of the budget, I actually did price out these just two pieces, and they actually cost just a little bit over $100, but that's okay. But then in the process of trying them on, the guy talked me into one that fit better. Of course, the one that fit better was a little more expensive.
He upsold you.
So he upsold me. I totally got upsold. But hey, that's part of the Dragon Con experience. is getting guilted and sweet-talked.
So in some ways, you kept truer to the spirit than anyone else, right?
Absolutely. I got ripped off at Dragon Con.
There you go.
So the guy said to Steve, well, you can put this one on, but you're going to look like shit.
Yeah. Like, you know, this fella doesn't really fit you. This one, you know. Yeah. So, yes. Yeah, so
now, wait, he said that this was one from Japan and that someone used to own.
Yeah, these are previously owned. Right.
So it's freaking used.
Or it's vintage.
Okay. now you're being the salesman, Steve.
So... yeah, so this is $160 for what I'm wearing.
Wow.
Not that crazy. Going that much over budget. Whatever.
It didn't matter. If it was $101, he was over.
So, all right, but I will absolutely defend my Samurai Jedi premise. And I did a lot of research about this, actually. There's a lot of overlap between the Jedi and the samurai. They're both knights, right? They're both knightly orders. They're both have a strict honor code. And their identity centers a lot around their sword. The samurai sword is as iconic and as a part of their spirit and identity as the lightsaber is to the Jedi. Now, there's a lot of debate online, as you can imagine. Like, what nerdier debate can you have? Like, how much did the samurai inspire the Jedi? And Lucas has given conflicting feedback on that.
He says, don't say.
Yeah. He says, oh, yeah, sure, they were an inspiration, but then he downplays how much. It's like, man, but most of the similarities are coincidence. But there's the Hidden Palace or something, the Forbidden Palace.
Yes.
Hidden Fortress.
Hidden Fortress.
The Chris Allen movie, yeah.
It's basically A New Hope, right? The plot of that movie, there's a lot. I mean, the similarities are not just a coincidence between those two movies. And that movie is told from the perspective of two peasants, which a lot of people think is the same as telling A New Hope from the perspective of the two droids. Like, they play the same role.
Well, you the first act. You follow the droids. Yeah. Those are our connective tissue, yeah.
Exactly. So I think, yeah, absolutely he ripped off the Hidden Fortress.
All right, Steve, we got an hour. We got many news items. Jay, what do you got?
So I had a similar idea to Steve. I was told I can't use Steve's idea because it was his idea. Even though the original idea was I was going to be a geisha, a female geisha. My wife had all
nailed it,
right? I was going to do it. So then we were all the way like, okay, we picked everything out. We were going to do it, and then we happened to have a conversation with Steve, and he's like, "Well, I already bought mine, so you're effed." Yeah. So I'll say it straight. This costs more than the budget.
It's
awesome.
Can you stand up and show it off?
Yeah, so the bottom line is my daughter is turning 2 on September 9th, and we're having a pirate-themed 2-year-old birthday party, and I couldn't let her down. I'm her dad, and I got to be a pirate for my daughter.
Jay, is it a party or is it a party?
It's a party. Can I tell my best pirate joke?
Of course.
You can't say that. A pirate walks into a bar with a steering wheel,
captain's
wheel attached to his zipper.
I think they know this.
I don't care if they know it. My dad told me the same joke.
The wave of groans coming.
They will laugh out of respect, goddammit. Goes into a bar with a captain's wheel attached to his zipper, and the bartender's like, "What the hell is that?" And he goes, "Arr, it's driving me nuts."
Groan.
Oh, you get it?
That wave of respect is washing it away.
I got more. I can keep going.
No.
All right, let's go.
Okay. Well, this was my second choice. I was walking through the vendors, and they were selling kilts. And I'm like, I don't know if I'll be able to afford a kilt. I talked to the guy. He said, we have kilts as low as $60. I'm like, wow, that's great. Here's what I want to do. I want to get a Hot Rod t-shirt like Rowdy Piper, the wrestler, used to wear. That was going to be my costume. $100, no problem. Cannot find a Hot Rod t-shirt. All right, so that idea went out. So then I'm thinking, I'm keeping the beard for the weekend, so what plays to sort of the strength of me being, furry and kind of, with this brownish sort of reddish, grayish beard that I have. And we're walking by, and my daughter Rachel and I say, hey, there's a hoodie. And guess what? There's a big sign on it. Chewbacca hoodies, $100.
So...
All right, perfect.
That's a fine plan, but you had, in the middle of the Atlanta summer, you had the opportunity to rock a kilt with that nice breezy feeling, and instead you're dressed for a Chicago winter.
I am sweating up here. I really am. I'm going to get this.
Plus, don't forget, sitting down wearing a kilt, I mean... Can't even see it. So well, good choice.
I guess I should stand up so everyone can see the Chewbacca. And I thought I might actually have
that
to buy a bandolier or strap, whatever. But no, it's all built in, accessorized, $100 on budget, and totally in my idiom. Thank you.
And Evan, what's the icing? Evan, the icing on the cake. It's reversible.
It is reversible.
What?
Yes. If you can see it from there, it reverses into the Empire Strikes Back version of the Han Solo, Solo jacket. So I don't have to go around looking like a total moron all the time wearing this thing in the winter.
Evan, you are so getting laid at Dragon
Ball. Oh, great. Thanks, Jay. My wife hears this. Yeah, right.
So, Bob, this is a little out of your wheelhouse. I'm kind of surprised, but tell us what you did here.
Yeah, this was an exercise in frustration for me. I take costumes very seriously. I spend lots of time on the costumes that I make. And, yeah, I mean, this is just, like, obviously thrown together. I went through the two floors of costumes and vendors, and I couldn't find anything. As I said earlier, everything I wanted was $300 to $500. So I said, all right, screw it. I'm going to be functional, like Steve. I'm like, all right, I'm obsessing about witches this Halloween. My party is going to be all witches all the time. It's going to be amazing. Wait till you see the pictures on Facebook. So I figured, all right, this cape would be a great witch cape. So I will use this for my hero witch in a couple months.
Warlock.
So I said, all right, what could I do? What could I add to this? So I figured, all right, you got to throw some horns. And then the horns and the cape would have been okay, but I needed a mask. So this mask put me a little bit over budget, about $20, but at least it's not like $100 over budget. So it is what it is.
You do realize Evan's the only one not disqualified so far.
Yes. Oh, touche.
Aha!
So far. All right, go ahead, Kara.
So my idea, I was walking the con floor for a while, and I'm kind of have the least sci-fi fantasy nerd cred on the panel, and so half the costumes, I don't even know what they are. And I'm trying to figure out what's something that I can do, and I have a stroke of genius. So I buy these. Actually, I don't even need to stand up because this is my costume. I buy these gray rabbit ears, and I decide that I will be a Bible thumper.
Hey. Nice one.
Problem being, I get back to my hotel room, and it's like the only hotel in America where there are no Bibles in the drawer.
Yay!
And I call the front desk, and I'm like, excuse me, there doesn't seem to be a Bible in my drawer. And they're like, we don't have any anywhere in the hotel. So Liz so nicely asked some of her friends and got me a Gideon Bible for my costume. And by the way, I made off with $75 extra in my pocket.
Wow.
I think I won the competition. In terms of costing.
In terms of that one very narrow criteria. Right. Now, Brian, tell us about your costume.
Yeah. I stole this from the producers of Hacking the System on National Geographic. We did a segment where I was a mechanic, and I'm wearing it now.
Good.
I love it. Brian,
eat shit. You should have renewed it.
Brian, you were so getting laid with that costume.
I will say, though, that our costume yesterday, we were in as a group costume as the Princess Bride. And my costume cost exactly $0. I managed to put together my entire costume without having to purchase a single thing.
What does that say?
Wait, yeah. Steve, before you go on, let the audience pick the winner.
Oh,
you really want to pick a winner?
Yes, come on.
I think we're all winners.
Well, this is a contest. I mean, there's, you know.
No, the way I say it, if you're in costume at Dragon Con and you're having fun, then you're a winner.
Aww.
Everybody wins.
Yay. He only says that because he knows he's a loser.
You don't know me. All right. There's a very, very quick news item. This is a new study that this is a little bit of extrapolation to 2020, but basically since 2001, efforts to vaccinate basically poor kids in, you know, Africa and parts of the developing world has saved an estimated 20 million lives and $350 billion. That's the power of vaccines. It is the most cost-effective and the greatest benefit to risk ratio of any medical intervention that we've developed, really. And this is just one more piece of evidence attesting to that. And what's interesting is that the two groups of people who are under vaccinated are poor people who can't afford it and rich people who are stupid. And it's really, and I'm being facetious when I say that, but it's basically privileged people who can afford it, but, you know, have disposable income, but this is the category that we call more money than sense, right? And they, because of just they've lived such a privileged life, they don't even know what it means to suffer from the diseases that we're vaccinating to prevent against. And so they had sort of the luxury of thinking that they could forego it. Plus, they're living in a place where community immunity is essentially protecting them to some extent, although, you know, measles and other diseases are coming back. Interestingly, the poor people who can't afford to get vaccinated appears to be an easier problem to fix, because you can just throw money at that problem, like Bill Gates. You can, you know, just pay to have them vaccinated, and they'll happily do that and save millions of lives and billions of dollars. It's a lot harder to fix the problem of ideology. preventing people from getting vaccinated.
Well, especially because from a fashion sense, the worst part is the first people to make it trendy to not get your kids vaccinated for whatever stupid excuse, they get away with it because they're benefiting from the herd immunity early on. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's like, beautiful rich white people are doing this. Let's follow.
My kid was fine, yeah. But the problem is they're congregating, you know, in communities and schools, and then they're getting outbreaks. You know,
there's another disease. I have a special needs daughter, and we were looking at schools, and there was one that everybody said was great until I heard the word, some don't vaccinate, and we were done.
Yeah. We're done. Yeah, absolutely. All right, Jay. So conspiracy thinking, conspiracy theories is definitely a very frequent topic on the SGU. And I think it's something that we absolutely have to understand. There was another study about it, so to give us the quick skinny on that.
Yeah, the basic question is, do people who believe in conspiracy theories, are they getting some type of emotional or psychological benefit from that? And the question that the study asked was, do they feel that they're unique and special in any way? So they had a few vectors here. One of them was they were asking the people who believe in conspiracy theorists, one, if they do believe that they're special, or do they have a need to be special? And two, they tried to figure out if they were prone to conspiracy theories. So let's say that you have yes for both of those questions. Then they went on to essentially rate them on 99 conspiracy theories. Do they believe in these conspiracy theories or not that were popular on the internet at the time of the study? And the answer was yes to most. And they found in the study that people that believe in one conspiracy theory tend to believe in multiple conspiracy theories. So it's a mindset. And then later in the study, they introduced a made-up conspiracy theory, which was a smoke detector emitting shrieking subliminal sounds that would affect people, right?
Shrieking subliminal sounds?
Yes, like there's sounds you can't hear. What do you call sounds you can't hear, but they're happening?
Subsonic.
Subsonic, yeah. And that these like waves of sound were coming out and that you know, nobody knows about it and whatever. And it turns out that 25% of the people in the study that were told, hey, we made this up for the study, still believed it.
Yeah.
Right.
It's totally believable.
So, I mean, there's a lot more details to the study. We don't have time to get into it, but it's fascinating how, first, we already knew these things. We already knew that people that believe in conspiracy theories tend to believe in more conspiracy theories. It is a mindset, and they are indeed getting a psychological benefit to it because it makes them feel special.
But I will say that previous studies have shown that also about it. But they do separate people into two groups. There are people who believe in conspiracy theories because they are in line with their ideology, right? So they're sort of opportunistic conspiracy theorists, and they tend to only believe in one or a very limited set of conspiracies that reinforce a pre-existing belief system or tribal ideology. So, for example, if you are on the far left, you might think that 9/11 was an inside job, but not necessarily believe in any other conspiracies. Yeah. Or if you're on the far right, you might think that global warming is, you know, is a hoax, but you wouldn't necessarily believe in any other conspiracies. But then there were all-purpose conspiracy theorists. They believed in conspiracies because they believed in conspiracies. Yeah. And regardless, across the spectrum, they believed in every one, and it wasn't tied to ideology. And that seems to be the group that they were keying in on in this study, showing that those people, you know, there is a psychological feedback that's going on.
Yeah, and this is an anecdote, I know, but in my personal experience, it proves out. And I'm curious to poll the audience. Those of you who do know people that believe in a conspiracy theory, raise your hand if they believe in more than one conspiracy theory. Oh,
sure.
My God.
That's most of the audience.
Wow,
yeah.
That's serious.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's
We have a family member that believes in conspiracy
theories. Yeah, we don't have time to get into that.
We don't have time. It's all true. Just believe.
Yeah. Just listen to the show. You'll
All right, so this is some recent news. Obviously, everyone knows that a very bad storm hurricane has hit Texas. Kara, that's where you live. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, so this is near and dear to my heart because I was born and raised in Texas. I actually grew up in North Texas, but as any Texan in the audience might know, if you're from Texas, you have family all over Texas. So I have aunts and cousins and lots of friends in Houston, and I've been checking in with them over the past few days. Hurricane Harvey is officially now the rainiest Atlantic hurricane on record. So it has broken one of those limits. There's a weather station in Harris County called Cedar Bayou Weather Station, and it reported 51.88 inches of rain from start to finish of Harvey's landfall. That's the most rain ever recorded on U.S. soil from a tropical cyclone. It beats rainfall records for any other storm in Texas, and the only other storm on U.S. soil
to actually, it actually beats it by on non-continental U.S. soil, it beats it by, what would that be, 0.12 inches, was Tropical Cyclone Hiki in Kauai, Hawaii, in 1950. It actually recorded 52 inches, but that was not an Atlantic
Atlantic cyclone. Yeah, that wasn't mainland either.
Yeah, and it wasn't mainland. The Weather Service even had to color their maps with new colors to signify, because all of their maps only went up to 30 inches and to a deep red, so they had to add purple to them.
Oh, that was been a fun meeting. What color are we going to have?
I know, right?
30 to 40 inches, fuchsia?
And so a lot of people ask, well, is Harvey the worst storm on record? I mean, what about Sandy? What about Katrina? What about Galveston in 1900? There are a lot of different ways to define worst. And so I just wanted to kind of pick out a few of them. It's definitely the rainiest. We know that. In terms of actual property damage, it may be. It may not be. We still don't know. By comparison, Superstorm Sandy cost about $70 to $90 billion in repairs after property damage. Katrina was around $160 billion. And some estimates put Harvey between $70 and $190 billion. That's a pretty wide range. So we'll have to wait and see on that.
Could be more.
Death toll, though, nowhere near the greatest, thank goodness. The number may still grow, but as of yesterday, the count was 47 lives lost, which is no small thing. Compare that to Katrina, though, where 1,833 people lost their lives. And closer to home, something that we all learn about in Texas history when we grew up in Texas was the Great Galveston Hurricane of 1900. And that killed between 6 and 12,000 people. It's the deadliest storm on record on United States soil. In terms of wind speed, the highest ever was Camille in 1969 at 190 miles per hour.
Oh, wow.
Harvey, Sandy, and Katrina didn't even top the list. Harvey's peak was only 130 miles per hour, making it a Category 4 right as it started, but then it quickly was demoted. Katrina and Sandy were actually only Category 3 hurricanes, but they caused an awful lot of damage. So we've got to remember, it's not just these factors to worry about. A lot of it has to do with infrastructure. A lot of it has to do with readiness. Houston is one of many 600 cities in the United States whose storm sewers and wastewater sewers use the same pipes. And so because of that, when the storm sewers overflow, open sewage makes its way into the street. So a lot of this water here that you're seeing, the concern there is that this water is full of cholera and dysentery and a lot of other disease-causing bacteria. Also, a lot of chemical plants were right there in the wastewater. So there's a lot of danger just waiting around. But I think the thing that's most important for us to dive into before we move on is climate change. This is the so-called 500-year flood. Based on calculations.
I heard 1,000, is that?
Could be, yeah, we're still waiting. Yeah, we're still waiting to figure out, but a conservative estimate, this is a so-called 500-year flood. The third of the last 3 years in Houston. So we know that we cannot link a single storm to climate change. We can't say climate change caused Hurricane Harvey, but what we can say is that this pattern of increasing intensity is actively and clearly predicted by the models. Hurricanes are powered by seawater evaporation and heat. That's what causes the hurricanes to spin and to increase in their frequency. As it gets hotter, they intensify. And the Gulf of Mexico right now is 2 entire degrees Fahrenheit hotter than it was only 30 years ago. And so we can see a lot of effects happening because of that.
And one quick point, because we got this clarification before. I think it's just a little interesting little tidbit. Yeah. Climate change models do not predict an increase in the number of hurricanes. Yeah. I think people conflate that. It's actually just the intensity of the ones that do exist.
Yeah. And so a lot of the features of Harvey, a lot of climatologists say, yes, these are in keeping with the model. The amount of rainfall, the intensity at which it actually picked up speed before it made landfall instead of breaking down, which a lot of hurricanes are known to do. But one of the biggest problems with Harvey is that it just stayed in one place for a long time, dumping water. That doesn't seem to be linked to climate change. It's just a wonderful fluke, just a horrible thing that happened. But I do want to point out that while we're focused on Houston, none of us should forget that there was a horrific monsoon season this year in Nepal, India, and Bangladesh, and over 12,000 people have lost their lives already. 40 million people have been displaced, and these, without a shadow of a doubt, are climate refugees. This is absolutely an effect of climate change, and we have to remember that. So the question is, what can we do? Anyone? There is hope at the end of the
What could we do in the future? I mean, I thought the readiness of was impactful. I mean, remember,
compared to Katrina,
right?
Yeah,
like you know, I know this was a little dramatic, but they were asked to write their social security numbers on their forearms with a Sharpie, and I think that really resonated with people. I mean, I have friends, and I asked them, "What did you think about that?" Yeah, that was like, okay, they think we're going to die.
Yeah, yeah.
So it helped kind of set the tone, like get the hell out of here.
Well, yeah. One thing we could do: what if we, you know, just like do something silly, like elect people that believe in climate change?
That would be a good start.
Or Bob, you know. People that have 50,000 seat churches could open their
freaking doors and help people.
What's that guy's name?
Austin, Joel Austin.
What a complete scumbag.
Yeah.
But in infrastructure, so deaths from large storms like this are the two biggest factors are how much water gets dumped and infrastructure. Mm-hmm. It's actually not the wind. It's not a lot of other things that we use to measure the severity of the storm, but it's just water and infrastructure. And Houston, I know, I don't know if you're going to get into this, but have lots of problems with their infrastructure. They just didn't plan. They put a lot down, a lot of pavement, which gave the water nowhere to go.
That is exactly, that's exactly one of the points that I was going to make. Houston is one of few large cities. It's the fourth largest city in the country. It doesn't have any anti-sprawl legislation. There's not really, it's like minimal in terms of zoning. So Houston has massive amounts of urban sprawl. And when urban sprawl occurs, basically, we're paving over wetlands. And in cities like in the Netherlands, where they've dealt with flooding for hundreds of years, they have really been a model, and actually Miami and New Orleans are starting to adopt their models. If you preserve green spaces, and especially coastal wetlands, you're actually providing a place for the water to naturally flow. The premise of trying to stop the water from coming in with walls is not tenable. You have to let the water come in and divert it to places where it will naturally drain and flow. Houston actually did have some good infrastructure in place because they've had previous flooding with reservoirs, but they couldn't handle the amount of rain. And by some estimates, because of the coastal wetlands in the Pacific Northeast, when Hurricane Sandy hit, it mitigated 22% of the damage. It would have been 22% worse if they had paved over all of those wetlands.
You know, hopefully,
so that's important.
Hopefully, you know, because of the law, the monetary loss, you know, other cities will say, hey, would you rather spend, you know, $50 billion right now and have it work for the next 50 years, or do you want to spend $50 billion to fix the mess?
Yeah, $190 billion, exactly. $190 every billion. Time this happens, which, you know, like we've seen, these 1,000-year storms are happening now every 20 years. These 500-year storms are happening every 5, 10 years. I mean, it's insane.
Well, we all wind up paying for it, ultimately. Absolutely. Everyone in the country does.
Sure.
Absolutely.
It's a satellite image.
So I got a question for you guys. Not that it matters, but I grew up in Houston. I went to Katy High School. So, and our neighborhood is hosting refugees. On the issue of climate change, I always I'm factually the most ignorant, dumb, scientifically illiterate person on this panel. But I do know people, and yes, there is an association between the climate change and the intensity of the storms and so on. But every time that point is brought up, I tighten up and worry that it legitimizes the argument of every time it snows, then they get to say, oh, where's your global warming now? Like is it, from a purely PR perspective, is that something that, is there a downside to maybe, putting that on Front Street?
No, I agree with you in that. Like many issues, there's nuance, right? Like the nuance of, you can't blame an individual storm on global warming, but we know that they're getting more intense, and that increases their the damage that they could do, and it means that they're overwhelming our infrastructure, et cetera. But you're right, people will take that nuance and say, oh, they're blaming the hurricane on global warming. They're, you know, and they're just as bad as the people say that snowing just...
Well, and to me, the most disgusting thing is that it legitimizes the counter-argument.
Yeah.
If all of a sudden we're going to play that game and we're playing blackjack and, I always hit and it always works.
Well, it gives them fodder. It does not legitimize their argument. And I think we need to make that distinction. I would much rather deal with, every so often, a James Inhofe taking a snowball to the floor than not make the argument for Bangladeshi... climate refugees. You know what I mean? I'd rather, because the globe on whole, is in on this, and we understand it. We've just got a few really, really dumb politicians.
Yeah, I don't think you can fix the problem by avoiding the nuance, because it's not going to really keep them from making stupid arguments.
Yeah.
You have to educate people about the nuance, so they're one step ahead of it. I think it's, you know, it's harder to do that, but I think that's our only option.
Sure.
It's like anti-vaxxers and the way they manipulate you know, the data on safety. You say, well, they can't prove it's zero risk. It's like, yeah, okay, that's true. But you can't prove there's zero risk about anything. This is how science works, et cetera. It takes you a couple of steps to get them to understand it. But I don't know what the other option is because, you know, you dumbing it down doesn't work because they exploit that even worse.
Well, I'll tell you this much. Like, I know that emotionally charged moments are when con men thrive, right?
Yeah,
and so
sure.
I guess if I have a gut check on this as a magician or performer, I would say not now. Not now.
Yeah. Well, I hear what you're saying. Like, don't use this storm
right.
as an opportunity to proselytize about global warming.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
I think then you're right. Then if you're, because then it does open itself up to the charges of emotional exploitation, and that's not what we're about.
But do use the storm to motivate people to realize we need to be preventive instead of mitigative.
Right.
We've got to start, like, this is going to happen again.
Yep.
We know it's going to, so we've got to start taking preventive measures.
Yeah. It's like when you're having an argument with your wife. Like, that's not the time to get into the nitty-gritty. It's like, let's talk about tomorrow when we're not screaming at each other.
Right. Two words. Yes, dear.
Okay. All right. This is, I don't know what to think about this one. This is cool, amazing, and unbelievable at the same time. So, in Trakylos, Crete, which you, for those of you who are geographically challenged, is not in Africa. That's an island off of Greece. Paleontologists, experts in tracks of early humans, in fact, have identified and scientifically described footprints that they say are pretty sure are from a human ancestor, and they're pretty sure 5.7 million years old.
Oh, boy.
Damn.
Uh-oh.
That's not right.
No.
Uh-oh. That ain't supposed to be. So here's a close-up of it.
Does that disprove evolution?
Yeah, how do we
prove
exactly.
Is there a dinosaur?
See, therefore, God.
I mean, I know, I guarantee you that Michael Egnor will say this disproves evolution. I guarantee you. Anyway, so there's a close-up picture of it. So a couple of questions here before we talk about the implications of this. One is it really a human ancestor?
Yeah.
So
is it a footprint? It looks kind of a little vague.
It looks like one
footprint, right, Steve?
No, it's a track, and this is just one of a series of footprints. So, you know, yes, obviously it's the order of them.
When did primates come on the scene?
Oh, primates, I mean, go back 15 million years.
Can we really make a distinction of a footprint between a primate ancestor
yes.
and a human ancestor?
Yes. Okay. So here's why. Mm-hmm. So humans and our ancestors have unique features that are not shared by any other primate. So what you're seeing here is at the bottom of the screen, that's the heel. To the left of this image is the ball of the foot. That's the hallux, the big toe. And then you don't see all five toes here. In other footprints, you could actually clearly see five toes, but there are then five toes. So all other primates, their big toe sticks out like our thumb sticks out. There's no other lineage other than our ancestors that we know of. That's a big.
They were prehensile, right?
Many of them were prehensile. Yeah. So our big toe points forward. That's it. Just us and our ancestors that we know of. So that's pretty clearly a primate footprint, you know, that's in our lineage or closely related. There's nothing about this that is a spoiler. There's no claws. There's no other features that would, you know, that's incompatible with it being a hominin. If you just look at scientists, look at that, okay, they're pretty sure that's human tracks, and it's bipedal, obviously. So what about the age, 5.7 million years old? Well, they sound pretty damn sure about that too, because this is this is probably mud on the side of a riverbank or a lake or something. And there are seashell fossils in the layer above and in the layer below, and they could date the layer above, they could date the layer below. In addition, they could date it in the Mediterranean, and the Mediterranean occasionally dries out. 5.6 million years ago, the Mediterranean dried out and left a unique and distinctive layer of sediment. That's where this is.
So what time frame would you traditionally think was expected?
Well,
how far off are we from what we would expect?
The other oldest human footprints were the Laetoli footprints, which were 3.7 million years old. So this is 2 million years older.
Huge.
The oldest evidence of humans outside of Africa is 1.8 million years old. So this, if this all adds up, this pushes humans out of Africa back 4 million years.
Wait. Don't jump to conclusions. Has anyone considered time travel?
Yes. There was a little like TARDIS
print, yeah. Square, a big square.
I'm just going to go back 5.7 million years and just run on the beach.
I get. I suppose another question
what
is,
could go wrong?
Why now? Why are we only discovering this now? I mean,
well, why are you discovering anything now? I mean, you can't just—it's just we come across stuff.
They just happen to.
So these
find
actually,
I mean,
we knew about these footprints for a while. I forget the exact date, but it was a human footprint expert taking a look at them and go, these need a closer look. And then he did a full scientific analysis, you know, the measurements and everything. It's like, yeah, these are human. And then they dated it. Like, yeah, shit, these are 5.7 million
Is there like, is there sort of a, just in case it doesn't check out, they're also kind of like this species?
No, right.
There's just
really
nothing else.
There's no alternative possible hypothesis for this.
I kept looking to see, is anyone throwing any shade on this, right? Is anyone saying that there's, oh, no, but this could be something else, and I haven't seen anything yet. So this is very recent. This is like a few days old. This needs to go through the meat grinder of peer review. This needs to, the community needs to weigh in on this. So, you know, this might be one of those stories where 2 months from now we're coming back and go, you know what? They said it's not true. And I wouldn't be shocked because that wouldn't be as shocking as it being real.
Yeah.
You know,
it
is the bottom line.
Is it the same individual who left all the footprints?
Yeah,
I believe so. So there could be potentially some sort of mutation or some sort of distortion.
Well, but that's, you know. Okay,
also
so,
very rare.
So that would be rare squared, right? Mm-hmm. This is a rare individual with a rare preservation. Generally speaking, you know, you're more likely to find common things than rare one-off individuals. But you know, hey, there could always be something like that in the record. So what could be going on here? The other thing is, so not only is this out of Africa 4 million years before we thought, not only is this, you know, a really human-looking foot, couple of million years before we thought, but this predates Ardipithecus. You guys remember Ardipithecus?
Yeah.
So Ardipithecus, now we're going back again more like 3.something million years ago, and that the hypothesis is that Ardipithecus was a human ancestor, and Ardipithecus's foot is more primitive, more ape-like than this. And so, and I know I've said this on the show before, what this means is that our tree of human evolution is so incomplete that there's probably branches all over the place that we have no idea about. And every time we find a new really good find of something new, it's actually expanding the puzzle. It's not filling in the puzzle. It's expanding it. And so who knows what the hell this is? And who knows if the creatures that we think are our ancestors, they might not even be our ancestors.
Exactly. There's so much.
It could have been a total side branch.
There's so much convergent evolution. We've seen things happen so many times in species where, you know, flight came about separately, where scales came about separately. And maybe there were these hominid-type features that came about, died off. And this could just be a dead end.
Yeah, or it just, they come out, they you get a side branch that will eventually lead to us, but the more primitive stuff survives for a long time. And so we encounter them much later in their life, their evolutionary life, and we think that's how far back they go. But really, something branched off from them 2 million years ago and has more quote-unquote modern features.
Can we even say that, you know, how far can we go back with, you know, we know that, you know, X number of years ago, we're 100% sure we evolved from them. Like, do we know that our grandparents were our grandparents? What's going on?
I think, you know, when you go back to Homo erectus, we're pretty clearly on the path to us. Homo erectus, Australopithecus is our cousin. Not Australopithecus. The Neanderthals are our cousin and us.
So when you go
and everything beyond that,
it gets very
unclear. Earlier than that, I think you get progressively unclear very quickly. Yep. And it wouldn't shock me if 20 years from now they're saying, you know what, Australopithecines are not on the path to us. It's this other side. It's this other path. I wouldn't be shocked at that. You know,
time to rewrite the books.
No, absolutely. Every major find is, and so take this with a huge grain of salt. It's too new and too out of what we already thought we knew to say this is it now. I wouldn't be surprised if after serious peer review, this isn't as bad as the neutrinos going faster than light. It's not quite that bad. But this is like, we have to take this with a serious grain of salt until it really gets poured over. And then when a year from now, the paleontologists are going, yeah, this is real. This
Steve,
is like
I have
probably
a great
real.
Idea.
Yeah.
follow the footprints until you find that guy's corpse.
Well, that's so. The other thing is, don't the little tidbit that this is out in Africa is huge.
Oh, yeah. Gosh,
although, but remember, right. Again, we talked about this with another find, the Graecopithecus, that. Yeah, but okay, but at the time, you could walk to Greece, you know, from Africa. So this is actually, they were far more ranging than present-day Africa. And Crete was, you could walk to Crete from mainland Greece at this time, so it wasn't an island. So it's not as outrageous as you think that these are ancestors. So I think what this tells us definitely, no matter where this ends up fitting in, is that are the hominins, the bipedal, you know, primates, was a much more bushy and you know
and widespread,
yeah, right. Widespread successful.
So
clade.
Would you call that an ad hominin? Look, I'm trying. You are trying. I'm up here. I'm just spitting them out.
I'm like it.
All right, Bob. Like, Bob, where does stuff come from?
God.
Very, you had 2 minutes to tell me where stuff comes
the
from.
Avengers and Dragons.
Now I got 2 minutes.
All right.
So scientists are saying that they may have resolved the mystery of where some of the heavy elements that we find all over the universe come from. Now, Carl Sagan has lots of famous quotes. One of his most famous quotes is that we are made of star stuff, right? Who has not heard that quote? And it's so right. We've got calcium in our bones. The very carbon atoms in our DNA were cooked up in stars. That's stellar nucleosynthesis. But there's a little bit of a problem. The heavier elements, the golds, the uraniums, the platinums, that's a kind of a different process. Regular stars are not going to cook them up. You need dramatic environments like a supernova, like colliding neutron stars. But the thing is, if you look at that, there's still so many heavy elements in the universe that the supernovae and the neutron mergers can't account for it. So where are these heavy elements coming from? So one theory that these guys came up with is that primordial black holes are kind of merging with neutron stars and producing these heavy elements. Now primordial black holes are, you know, they're primordial. They're not the remnants of stars. They're actually the byproducts of the Big Bang itself. So that means that they don't need to be massive. They could actually be very, very tiny. They could be atomic scale. But we're talking, imagine taking 44 quintillion pounds and shoving that into the space of an atom. I mean, this is some dense stuff. I mean, that's why I guess they call it a black hole. But it's very, very tiny. So the idea is that the neutron star that kind of sucks in the black hole, they merge, the black hole takes up residence by the core, and it just starts devouring the neutron star from the inside. I mean, it is a black hole, even though it's tiny. And then what happens is that this neutron star, as a byproduct of this process going on, towards the end of the neutron star's life, it's going to spit out this matter that becomes these heavier elements, the uraniums, the golds, and the platinum.
So, Bob, that means a part of the neutron star is outside of the event horizon of that black hole that's cannibalizing it?
Well, sure. I mean, imagine a neutron star, which is about as big as what? A city?
A city, yeah.
A city, and you've got a primordial black hole, which is smaller than an atom, in the center. And it's kind of just
when
like
slowly...
When
you say smaller than that, you mean the event horizon is smaller than an atom?
I mean, this thing is tiny, super tiny. So
this artist rendering that we're looking at...
That's just a conception of a neutron star that could, you know...
So is this sort of the stuff spinning around it, the ejecta in this artist rendering?
You know...
Like maybe full of those heavy elements?
Possibly. I think that's what the artist was going for.
Okay.
I mean, they really, trying to visualize this stuff, good luck. It's mostly a pretty picture, you know? It's kind of a cool picture. So here's what the author said. They said, as the neutron stars are devoured, they spin up and eject cold neutron matter, which decompresses, heats up, and makes these elements. That's how they described this nucleosynthesis of the heavier elements. Don't kind of worry about how something can decompress and heat up. I mean, we're talking about, you know, degenerate nuclear matter. Crazy stuff happens.
Degenerate nuclear matter. Hanging out in the Mos Eisley cantina.
So what I really liked about it, I mean, this is fascinating, but what really got my attention with this theory, that they're proposing that they're solving a mystery of where all these heavy elements come from. But in the process, the mathematics kind of says, well, yeah, but we're also solving a couple of other mysteries. And to me, that's really powerful. For example, these anomalous positrons from the galactic core of our galaxy, galaxy has been detected. We're not sure what's going on there. The theory may explain them. And then here's another one. You know, ever hear of fast radio bursts?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
This theory may explain them. Now, hey, so those are those radio bursts that come from the deep cosmos, and we're not sure where they're coming from. They're really weird. This might explain that. So to me, that was really, really cool. So see what happens with this.
All right. Evan, your favorite celebrity, Gwyneth Paltrow, what's she been up to?
Yeah, right. We all know what she's been up to.
Evan, you chose the greatest photo of her, by the way.
She must have somebody go online and edit and pull up all the bad photos, because it's hard to find kind of a bad photo of her.
But I feel like, that's just post-vagina steam right there. Like, what's happening?
But she has a jade egg in her at that
moment. Exactly.
Or right, she's having a deep thought or something. She has this health and wellness website we know of called Goop. She's been doing this for some time. It's basically selling very expensive products to mostly women who can afford these kinds of things, and they're absolute hokum bunk crap. Truthinadvertising.org, they did an investigation into Goop's marketing, and they revealed more than 50 instances in which the company claims, either expressly or implicitly, that its products can treat, cure, prevent, and alleviate the symptoms of or reduce the risk of developing number of ailments, which include crystal harmonics for infertility, rose flower essence tincture for depression, black rose bar for psoriasis, and wearable stickers for anxiety. Oh, plus some vitamin D3 for cancer, for helping with your cancer.
Yeah, and just to be clear there, that phrase that Evan read was not random. That's the FDA rules, right? So in other words, you're saying for 50 products, she's breaking the FDA regulations by making claims that she's not allowed to, disease claims.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, our friends at truthinadvertising.org, Connecticut-based action group, by the way, which is where we're from, last week, they filed a complaint with two California district attorneys urging the regulators to investigate Goop's marketing and take appropriate enforcement action. And they've had success with some of these companies in the past, to tune of making some of these scam companies fork over lots of money, millions and millions of dollars. So, you know, we've seen this before, in which companies, yes, they've been penalized, they've been fined, and so forth. Unfortunately, it's not going to stop Goop from doing what they're doing, but maybe it will, you know, hurt their wallet and their pocket.
Yeah, it's the cost of doing business.
Which is about what we can do. So real quick, the folks from Goop have been defending their claims. They suggest that maybe it's not smart to trust evidence-based science all the time. They say studies and beliefs that we held sacred even in the last decade have been proven to be unequivocally false and sometimes even harmful. Meanwhile, other advances in science and medicine continue to change and save lives. See what they did there? It's not a perfect system. It's a human system. And Gwyneth herself was asked this on a podcast just a few days ago, and she says, it's very clear on what we're doing. We stand behind everything we do. She's doubled, tripled, quadrupled down on all of this.
Evan, would you say that she is a bigger asshole than Tom Cruise at this point?
Oh, that's a good. That's a tough one, Jay. That's really tough.
Let's poll the audience. There is Gwyneth Paltrow a bigger asshole than Tom Cruise? Raise your hand.
Or how about clap?
Good.
Oh, wow.
That's about half, which is about what I would expect.
Hey, everyone. We're breaking in from our live show to do a little chat and to talk about a couple of news items that have happened since we recorded this episode live at DragonCon. And then we'll get back to the science or fiction segment to close out the show when we're done. I'm joined here by J. Bob and Evan. Kara is traveling today. She is a busy girl. Mm. She has a lot of stuff going on. The boys are all available because we have no lives, right, guys?
Basically, yeah. That's kind of what it boils down to.
Or so you think.
Now, she's busy doing work. She works really, really hard.
That's right.
She's a freelancer, and she gets called somewhere. She's got to fly out whoever knows where to, you know, be in a TV segment somewhere. At this point, for us, we've been back from DragonCon for a couple of days. Have you guys recovered yet?
This is like time travel a little bit with the episode. Recovered? Sure. Yeah, I think I'm recovered. I think I've come down from the DragonCon high. It is a high unto itself, and it's a fantastic feeling because it's so much fun.
It is a lot of fun. Yeah, we really enjoy doing DragonCon every year.
You know, going to DragonCon for me and my wife, Courtney, was like a break, you know? Like, we got actually some sleep because we had someone watching the kids. And, you know, we had a little, like, you know, adult time, which is very rare when you have young kids. But, like, I slept past 9 o'clock, which hasn't happened in, you know, 5 years.
I know. We were up. I think it was like Saturday morning. And like Joss and I were up at breakfast. And we're like, hey, where's Jay and Court? Like, yeah, just let them sleep. They got no kids for the first time in a couple of years. Yeah, right. Let them sleep as long as they want to.
Yeah, I was actually starting to get mad. I'm like, why can't they meet us for breakfast like everybody else at 8 a.m.? Then I'm like, oh, wait a second. They have no kids. They're sleeping. Let them sleep.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Wow, I didn't even realize I almost got a phone call at freaking 7:30 in the morning.
Right.
So, guys, what was your favorite thing at the con this year?
I've got a huge favorite thing. Somebody built the most perfect R2-D2, life-size, remote-controlled, fully functional, and, you know, full of all the R2-D2 sounds.
It was gorgeous. It was better than the movie R2-D2 because it actually had enhanced effects, like it's little digital readouts, lights, blinking lights were actually, I think, more detailed than the one used in the movie.
And its arms, it had the extended arms that R2 has shown in movies before. It was opening its doors, closing. It was very, very well done.
I went up to the builder, you know, you just scan around real quick and whoever's carrying a remote control, that's the guy that probably built it. So I went over and I asked him, you know, how long did it take? And he said it took him 2 full years to build it. And I just thanked him. I was like, I just want you to know, like, I love this con, but this is so by far my favorite thing at the con. And it really made me happy to see R2-D2. And it felt really cool because I think a lot of the other R2-D2s I've seen weren't actually the, you know, the quote unquote life size. They seemed a lot smaller than this one. You know, this stood 4 feet tall. That's how big R2-D2 was supposed to be in the movies. You know, he's that big. The original one is that big. And, you know, he did it. And not only was it the right size, but it looked like it was made out of stainless steel. That's how
it looked real. It looked as real as an R2-D2 robot can look, basically. Yep.
Jay, if you had that in your house, like, would you come home from work and like play with it every night, turn it on, fire it up and get it going?
Yeah, I've often wondered because I, in the way back of my mind, I'm like, you know, I would really like to own an R2-D2, you know, and I know there's companies that make them. I would enjoy building it, but I know I would never have the time or I don't have the engineering capabilities to do that. But Ev, I've thought it out to such a degree that I'm like, well, okay, if I ever did do it, then I would build a little like broom closet that he would live in. You know what I mean? You know, the door would open automatically just by me having him push forward and come out, you know? Oh, my God, yeah.
And you'd program him to make that high-pitched, you know, hello noise.
Yeah. Like, wow, yeah. Jay's home. There are so many really impressive builds at the con, but the other one I think that all caught our attention, and I was surprised by this, was a Darth Vader. And the reason why it was so surprising is because you see so many of them at the con. It's a very common costume, and I've seen full Darth Vader builds before, but this one was fantastic. It just looked so much better than any other one I've seen before. And again, it looked like it almost had enhanced special effects, and he had the breathing, and you know, it was Darth Vader. The guy was tall enough to be Darth Vader, and really, really great job. And the guy says he builds these costumes for sale, and they cost $10,000.
Yikes!
Can you imagine? That's a luxury.
So yeah, that was a costume. As you get closer and closer to it, it just kept getting better and better. And we're like, what? This is movie quality, first of all, or maybe even better than movie quality, probably better than the original. And then when he confirmed it, I was like, oh yeah, I would sell this for $10,000. I make them for a living. Like, oh, okay. I see where the money is actually in there. Fantastic.
I've seen the original Darth Vader helmet. I've seen like high resolution pictures of it that, you know, you would say, wow, that was it, because it didn't have to be perfect. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It looked actually a little fatigued in a weird kind of way. I was very surprised. This thing was pristine, and it was built at such an amazingly high quality. You know, I watched the guy's videos of him making it and everything that he does, and it really, his detail is amazing. Amazing.
When you think about it, up close in person has to be better. Like a prop that you see up close in person has to be a lot better than something that is just going to be on film.
Yeah, that's right.
The naked eye,
fine details. Yeah.
Something from the 1970s versus seeing something in person, right? Totally.
For me, the best was like completely random, unexpected, walking up one of the many hills near the hotels, and coming down towards me was a lumbering 8-foot-tall evil Santa Claus thing with a gaping maw like a shark. This thing was, I was like stunned. So of course I whip out my camera, get ready, and I videotape him. Not just a picture. This guy was movie quality ready. I had to take a video of him in action, and he walks right up to me and he points some little thing he was carrying at me, and and it was just one of those things that if I wasn't walking up that street, I would have missed it, never seen it, because I didn't see him before or since. And it's just, it's a little actually frustrating to think that there's these fantastic mega costumes that are at the con that are just so brief, you could just miss it and you'll never see it and you probably won't even see a picture of it. So it's, I just like getting out there and just seeing as many costumes as I can, because you never know when something just magical is just going to appear right in front of you.
But you know, my God. Some of the ones I like best, I mean, yeah, we have to ogle at the really fantastic quality builds, but the, some of the best costumes are very simple and probably very cheap, but it's just a great idea.
Yes.
So like in any interesting mashup, you know, where you just take two genres and put them together in an interesting way, I always love that. Or if somebody is just doing a really good job of acting the part, my favorite acting costume was a family. It was clearly a family. They did The Shining, so they did, you know, Jack and, you know, the mother and the two creepy girls.
Oh, nice.
You know, the two creepy girls from The Shining.
Enough
and
said.
They play with it was us. Clearly, yeah, it was their twin daughters. So these two twin girls who were about the right age, like 10 years old,
perfect.
Were fully dressed as those two girls, and they were acting it. They were working those roles. They were being very, very creepy.
I like the actors, when they the costume. It's not just cosplay, it's actually they're acting out the roles. My daughter Rachel was with me, and she saw a character from one of her video games, and it was this undead woman of some sort, and she was very slowly sort of creeping along, and it freaked us both out. Her acting more than the costume itself, but it was great. It was great. She really captured it perfectly and had everybody around her staring at her. It was awesome.
Well, guys, I want to talk about a couple of news items that have happened since the con in the last couple of days. A couple of quick, fun ones. So we've talked about Space Junk before, right? You guys know this is a huge issue.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There are 20,000 trackable objects orbiting the Earth, you know, that are pieces of, that are junk. They're not satellites. There's, you know, millions of objects that are smaller than a marble, that are teeny, you know, that they're, but there's
whizzing around the Earth at a crazy speed.
And the problem is they're all going very, very fast, and they're a menace. There's about 500,000 pieces that are a marble or larger, and millions that are smaller. But that's 500,000 like marble-sized or bigger pieces orbiting around the Earth, and they're traveling at speeds up to 17,500 miles per hour.
Whoa.
So that, you know, obviously that can cause a lot of damage.
And remember, though, we have to say, though, at this point that it's not just like, oh, these things are going fast and they could really hurt you or they could blow up a satellite. That's bad. But we have to consider a worst case scenario. And that's the cascade where you have, you know, one satellite blow up because of an impact and then that blowing up other satellites. Eventually, at the end of that run, you basically have low Earth orbit that is, you know, completely uninhabitable. You cannot go through there for probably decades or centuries because of all this debris. That's a worst case scenario, and that's like a pretty horrible. Imagine losing all of your satellites and the ability to go into space because of that. So that's bad. That's not like, you know, oh, we may lose something. This is like we lose our ability to go into space for centuries.
You know, I think for centuries we would, you know, that would give us a lot of time to do something about it.
True.
But without the worst case scenario, the fact is we're putting more and more stuff into low Earth orbit, into useful orbits. And we're just cluttering it up more and more, you know, just by putting stuff up there.
Right. We're not helping the problem. We're making it worse.
Yeah. Every time we launch something, right, Steve?
Yeah, pretty much. Any unused stages of rockets, satellites that are past their life expectancy.
James Doohan's up there somewhere.
Yeah. And just debris. Yeah. Right. And when things do collide, that does cause, you know, the smaller debris. So we need to do two things, basically. We need to have some standards so that when anything new that gets put into space, into orbit, there's a plan for what's going to happen to it at the end of its lifetime so that there's something built into it that will automatically deorbit it, for example.
That's a no-brainer. That should be law right now.
Yeah, it should have been law 50 years ago.
Yes,
you know?
Agreed.
You know, basically we cluttered up low Earth orbit. We were treating it like a bottomless pit, and now we realize it isn't, and like so many other things. But the other thing we're going to have to do is some way, we have to figure out a way to deorbit or get rid of in some way the debris that's already there, because it already is a hazard, you know, to any space station, any satellites, anything we want to put up there. So we talked about this on the show before and some methods of doing that, but we're bringing it up again because there's a new proposal, which is called the BrainCraft, Brain, B-R-A-N-E, which is a super thin, it looks like just a super thin sheet, you know, almost like a, you know, like a blanket or something that essentially would envelop debris and change its orbit and then deorbit it. But and the good thing is that it could theoretically be reused.
How would that possibly work? I'm having a hard time figuring that out.
Space net, like a cheesecloth or something.
Right, it's just not making sense. It would have to be traveling at the same speed as the debris.
Right.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's going to rip right through it, and then that gives, that's then you have the whole problem of, you know, finding the fuel that you would spend getting up to speed for that one specific object.
Yeah, I think that is, no matter what the method of it, of capturing the debris is, the method of sending something up to somehow grab it and then deorbit it is probably going to be prohibitive. Okay, but the brain basically is a dynamic object. So it could be, you know, it could curl up to get it into orbit, then it could unfold and flatten out. So it's kind of like two-dimensional, you know, when it's mm-hmm. fully unfurled. So it doesn't have to be that heavy, which is obviously important. They say 35 grams for 1 square meter, so that's not a lot. So it does have, it somehow that has the ability, it has thrusters though on it somewhere. It spreads out like a sheet so it could capture the debris, and then it will automatically envelop it, you know, and then it slows it down so that it deorbits.
Hmm.
So this is just a proposal. I mean, it's very problematic. I mean, it's just another way of capturing the debris. The other plans include things like harpoons or magnets or nets, right? You need, basically, as you said, Bob, you need to roughly match its orbit. You need to find some way to capture it. Then you need to slow it down to deorbit it. And then you need to somehow go on to the next bit of debris.
Yeah, so whatever it is, it has to be controllable.
It has to be controllable, and it has to burn fuel. So it should be light. So something that's light and could cover a huge area. So I guess that's the idea with the brain, is that it's light and big. So it could cover a large area. But still, I think there's just too much stuff up there.
Yeah.
500,000, you know, bits of debris. This is going to be really expensive. So probably a totally different approach is to use a ground-based laser.
Yes, yes, yes.
So as like the debris is coming over the horizon, you could shoot the laser at it in the other direction. So you're basically pushing against it with the laser so it slows down and then deorbits.
Nice. Right. That, to me, that's something that needs some serious consideration, and it makes a lot of sense. You're not putting anything in orbit. The only thing that I think would make it a little bit extra complicated is that you would have to figure out – when you deorbit it, what's the impact going to be on other debris, you know, because you could have some unpredictable interactions. But that seems to be doable because they're pretty good, you know, when they track stuff, they know where it is. It's the little stuff that they're not tracking, I guess, that could be a problem. But that sounds like a great idea. There's apparently a concern about, yeah, but you could also use that laser to actually destroy satellites in space. Well, sure. But I mean, there are things you could do to make sure that it can never be that powerful or whatever. But I mean, this is such a concern. If you want to build a powerful laser to shoot down satellites, that's already been done. China did that years ago. You know, it's not something that's going to be incredibly difficult for a country to do.
Pretty much any system you develop to deorbit space junk could be an anti-satellite weapon.
There
right?
you go.
I mean, so
good point.
And the more efficient it is at getting rid of space junk, the more efficient it's going to be as an anti-satellite weapon. I think that's an unavoidable consequence, and we just have to just agree not to do that. You know, maybe make it an international effort, like something that's run by the out of the UN, where we say, okay, we're going to use this internationally to clean up space for everybody, but we're not going to use this as a weapon. You know. Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, how would that work for the bigger, really big satellites, though? That would probably – would it still – obviously, maybe it would take many, many orbits and hits with the laser to do it. But somebody on your blog, Steve, made an interesting point on this, you know, for deorbiting the larger stuff. Actually, and it was interesting. He said that if you look at any satellite with mass, or any even debris in space that has mass, that mass in orbit represents a major investment in money. It's imbued with all this net worth, inherent net worth, but just based on the effort it took to get it up there, and and deorbiting it is kind of like a waste unto itself. So why not kind of gather all of it together into one thing and do something useful to all that former debris in one space by, you can get the expensive metals out of it. You can kind of turn it into other objects, whatever. But that's an interesting idea by not devaluing the high.
Yeah,
the high,
I mean, I thought about that too. Satellites. I mean, yeah, we've already spent the money to put all that mass up there. It is a waste to just have it burn up in the atmosphere. Right. But do we really have the technology to do that? Because now you're basically talking like an orbiting manufacturing platform that somehow gathers up space debris and uses it as raw material to make stuff out of. Okay, that would be great if we had the technology to do that. But is that practical? Is that pragmatic?
Right now, not right now. That's true.
Someone else also brought up the idea, why can't we just shoot up rockets full of water? The water disperses into a cloud, which, and then as debris hits the cloud of water, it slows down and deorbits. And the water itself could be on a suborbital trajectory, so it will just come back down. It won't stay up in orbit. And of course, you could do that with anything.
Yeah.
You could send up anything on a suborbital trajectory, right? It goes up and comes down, so it's not going to stay in orbit. But it can intersect the lower end of orbit.
Right.
And so it'll just hit any of the debris, knock it out of orbit, and then everything falls to the ground. And I actually found a paper from 2009 discussing that very thing, using water as a way of knocking low-hanging space junk out of the lowest orbits. But again, it seems like there'd be a lot of problems with using water. I think it would vaporize and crystallize almost instantly, right? In space, so
yeah, just a problem.
And then would it be dense enough to really be effective? I mean, there's probably a reason why it hasn't happened in the last.
I like the laser idea a lot.
The laser idea is probably the best idea.
Probably.
Wouldn't it be cool if the day they turn that thing on, it takes down 1,000 objects a day? Right. How long would it take for it to deorbit something?
500 days. If it took 1,000 objects down a day, it would take 500 days to get rid of anything as the size of a marble or bigger.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm just picking a number out of thin air. But yeah, no, the number is just slowly increasing every time something launches.
Hell, they should turn it into an attraction, invite the kids out to knock down some junk. Yeah.
Yeah. So space junk is one of those problems, like not hardening our grid against the CME
antibiotic
resistance, just looming there in the background and not getting a lot of political attention, but probably should be.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. One other quick thing. This came out of nowhere today. I haven't heard anything about this. The U.S. House today, as we're recording this on Wednesday, the 6th, unanimously approved a sweeping proposal to reduce regulation on self-driving cars, basically paving the way for manufacturers to get self-driving cars on the road, even going as so far as prohibiting state regulations that would inhibit the deployment of self-driving cars.
And to me, this was surprising. I would have thought it would have been the opposite, that they would have wanted to implement regulations, more regulations, as opposed to deregulating.
Now, Republicans are all about deregulation. But what's interesting is, I hadn't heard a peep about this, and suddenly there's a unanimous bill out of the House. But this is just today. We need time to really pour over this and to try to find out what's actually in this bill. And of course, the Senate has to come up with their own version, and then it's something very different will probably pass. But it sounds like the key idea here is that there are regulations for getting new cars approved that are unnecessary for a self-driving car and is just in the way. It's just slowing down the process of developing self-driving cars unnecessarily. You know what I mean? Like, because these cars would be inherently safer you know, because of the self-driving software. That's the idea anyway. Apparently, there's also regulation about any innovative or like new car technology, auto technology. And that would be a huge hurdle to get over with self-driving cars. So now they're saying, listen, just show us that the car is as safe as a regular car and you're good. That's basically what the regulation says. Just show that the car is as safe as standard cars. You won't have to do any jump through any further hoops because it's using a new technology, and the states can't slow it down either. Although the states still have the ability to do a lot of things like regulating the insurance and licensing and stuff like that. Depending. Yeah.
Yeah,
so licensing, liability, insurance, safety inspections, and registration, the states still handle all of that, but not performance standards. The performance standards are what, you know, the bill says the performance standards are basically what already exists for cars, and you can't make it higher, and the states can't make it higher either. There has been some expressed concern that, you know, this is just premature and that we, you know, that this is sacrificing safety, but that's kind of expected that somebody would make that point. But I think it, you know, it's interesting. I don't really have an opinion about it one way or the other yet because it's too new. I think we need to see what really is in there. What is the industry saying? What are safety groups saying? What are all the points on both sides before we see like who has any legitimate points to make? But, I do think it does remind me a little bit of like the hydrogen economy in that like politicians see this as the next great wave of technology and they want to make sure we catch that wave and that it's not being held up by lack of infrastructure, or in this case, unnecessary regulation.
Yeah, I agree. I think that they're trying not to get in the way of progress. And I think there's a lot of money backing this whole effort. So, you know, why would the government want to destroy industry?
Right, exactly. But of course, it is their job to make sure that new technology is safe. So there's always a balance between, you know, safety and innovation. And it's all about finding that right balance. I don't know if this bill does that. It definitely moves it significantly in one direction. Maybe that adjustment was necessary if the old regulations were out of date, which is the implication.
Mm-hmm.
From my perspective, it remains to be seen because it's still too new. It needs to be picked over. All right. Well, those are the two quick news items I wanted to bring up. Let's mention that the next conference the SGU is going to be at is SciCon Las Vegas, October 26th to 29th. So if you missed seeing us at DragonCon, you could see us in Las Vegas at the end of October. We will be doing a live show. I'll be giving a lecture. We'll be there to, you know, of course, meet our listeners. And we're going to try to arrange for a private show. I'm pretty sure that we've already sort of carved out time to do that, but we have to set up the exact details and we'll let you know what those are. The private shows are a lot of fun. We did one at DragonCon and you'll hear the one we recorded at DragonCon when we're at SciCon. We're going to use that episode for the week that we're at SciCon, but it was a lot of fun. I think the live audience really enjoyed it because it was a little unusual. Yeah. You know, we got really personal.
We've talked about things we've never talked about before.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah,
we got so personal that I assume some of it won't be making it to the show.
Yeah, a lot of it won't be making it to air. I mean, we said that specifically. Some of this is just for the live audience. It's like not, you know, for the broadcast version of the show. So we'd like to do that, you know, just to have some content there that's really just for the people, you know, who pay to be at the private show. So look for that for SciCon, and hopefully a lot of you could make it. We'll see you at the end of October. And a quick reminder, in just 1 week on Sunday, September 17th at 12 noon Eastern Time, U.S. Eastern Time, we're going to be doing an SGU live stream from our Facebook page. So check out our Facebook page, September 17th. 12 p.m. Eastern on Sunday. But that's it for this show. So we're going to go on with the science or fiction segment to finish up our live show at DragonCon.
I hope I get it right.
It's time for science or fiction.
All right. Hey, it's time for science or fiction.
Yeah.
All right, each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real, one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake, and we always poll our live audience when we do this.
So there is a theme here. We'll see if you can figure out what the theme is. It'll become pretty obvious. Item number one, the needleless hypo spray actually predates Star Trek. It was developed and used in 1960. Hmm. Item number two, China has developed a handheld heat ray gun that is lethal at up to 60 meters. And item number three, the U.S. military has developed Iron Man-type full-body armor with internal monitors and heads-up display. So the theme here is science fiction technology that has made it into reality of sorts.
Will somebody explain what hypospray is?
Yeah, so the hypospray is just a needleless hypodermic, right?
Oh,
so
okay.
Remember on Star Trek, they'll go, it's just air, and it goes in, there's no needle.
And it just makes it into your
Yeah, so you can,
dermis
yeah, so you can inject things subcutaneous or intramuscular without a needle.
Oh, all the way through. Okay,
yeah,
all right.
Right, exactly. Okay, so first we're going to poll the audience. Then we'll see what the people on stage think. Then we'll pull you again. We're going to do the single clap method. You guys all are familiar with this. When I drop my hand, you clap, and you got to be right on time. It does take a little bit of cerebellar function to get this correct. So if you're drunk, yeah. Okay.
It's a bit early in the
If
day.
You think that the needleless hypospray is the fiction, clap. Okay, not too many people there. If you think that the heat ray gun is the fiction, clap. And if you think that the Iron Man type full body armor is the fiction, clap.
Wow.
That was close. That was really close.
Yeah.
But I think there's a little bit of an edge number two there.
Yeah.
So let's see what you guys think. We'll start with you, Brian. Which one do you think is the fiction?
I remember reading 321 Contact magazine in the 1980s, and they said that hypersprays were already a thing. So that's close enough to 1960. And it it seems also like that's not rocket science. If you just do a blast of air with an aerosol in there, I don't see any reason number one couldn't be. And plus, you know, who's to say that wouldn't be the source of the idea in Star Trek? Number two, I think you're above making it a tricky, it's 80 meters, not 60 meters. But I do think the conundrum there is the heat ray gun. That's some tricky wording you got there. Because if you meant laser, you'd say laser.
It's not a laser. It's not a laser. It's just heat. It's just projecting heat. It's a heat ray.
You know what? I think we're done here. Number two is fiction.
Okay. Evan?
Okay, so I'll agree with the audience. I'll agree with Brian. It's the handheld heat ray gun. And handheld, I think, is what's getting me here. You're gonna heat ray a bunch of people, and you're going to hold this gun. I mean, what kind of glove do you have to, oven mitt or something, you've got to have on to prevent yourself from getting the bad end of this? So that one's fiction.
Okay, Jay?
It's kind of like a dragon, right? At 60 meters, and it can kill people. Like that, I'm visualizing it, and it's like, how long do you have to hold it on someone before it'll kill them? Can't they just walk out of the way?
Stand still over there.
What's happening?
Wait, you know what I mean?
So I think that one is the fiction.
Okay, Kara.
Oh, no. I mean, should I lemming this? I think the thing that's bugging me about the hypo sprays, I'm excited that is a thing already. I want to read more about how to get, because certain molecules just probably aren't small enough to pass through. You know, some drugs can be transdermal, but a lot of them, and to get to your muscles?
If I remember the 321 Contact magazine, I believe it said that it was actually more painful than a needle, which is why it wasn't very popular.
Okay, good to know. But the handheld heat ray gun, how hot is this? Like, I've been to spas where they have saunas that are like 220. You can literally walk into something that will make liquids boil and you don't die. You have to leave pretty quickly. But apparently, like, heat death, most people die from a fire because of smoke inhalation. They don't die because their skin is melted off of them. That takes a while. So this one, again, like, how do you kill somebody? Lethal is the thing that's bugging me about this. So I'll say that's the fiction.
Okay, and Bob.
You're going to screw us, Steve, on this one.
Well, he already has.
Well, then, like, because, line up, Bob.
Because the heat ray gun, it's clearly fiction. I mean, 60 meters. I mean, even all right, going with Jay's idea of that, how long are they standing there?
That doesn't even matter,
because if they stand there for a day, I mean, this thing, how could they have such a range and be handheld? So that one, to me, is obvious, but, oh, you're going to do something.
It could be two hands. I mean, it doesn't have to be
two hands. But still, it's not a flamethrower, right? It's just heat.
And it's not
like, it's just like, you've been outside in Las Vegas, right? Like, I just don't understand.
Right, I'm assuming that you're holding this thing, and it's not attached by a wire to like a room-sized device, right? I mean, right? It's kind of like,
like it's a trigger handheld. Like
right.
That would be...
All right, I'll go with the heat ray gun. If it's real, wow. But
man, I feel like we're just screwed. I feel like we're all right off that cliff.
Oh boy,
we're all in the same boat.
I don't think you can repoll the audience because they were pretty solidly on the heat ray gun as the fiction. So we'll start with number one, since I think that's probably the easiest one here. The needleless hypo spray actually predates Star Trek. It was developed and used in 1960. Most of the audience and all of the panel think that one is science. And that one is science. Yeah, so that's not that tricky a technology. It does use high air pressure and essentially a mist to get the whatever it is you're trying to inject to force it through, you know, the epidermis into the subdermal tissue or down even into the muscle. Wasn't developed to be painless, because it isn't. You know, it's pain is not the issue.
This might hurt a little.
It was developed so that you can do mass inoculation programs without having to change and dispose of needles.
Yeah, and for sanitary
reasons. It's faster,
reasons.
And it's also healthcare workers are at huge risk of sticking themselves if you're managing hundreds of needles, you know, in rapid succession. So it's just to get rid of the risk of the needle itself, but not to be painless for the recipients, probably not that. It's actually not that different.
You know, do we use it still?
So yeah, and there have been other. There's the PharmaJet is the latest one that was developed a few years ago that is a little bit more high tech than the one that was developed in 1960.
I hope that's 57 years ago.
Yeah. So all right. So the basic technology of getting, you know, injecting stuff across the skin with aerosol is that's not the trick here. But there are downsides. The real reason why it never became popular wasn't because it hurts, because people don't like needles either. And there's a lot of people who are needle phobic, you know. Yeah. It's not so much the pain, it's just the fear of bodily integrity. Mm-hmm. So the real reason is it's actually not that sanitary.
Yeah, right. There would be a spray.
Yeah, there's a spray, there's blowback. It's actually not.
How about dosage? Is there an issue with that? You might not.
That actually is not that big a deal. You can regulate the dosage well enough. Immunity is actually could be even better than with a needle for some reason. Oh, yeah, so it actually works. So it works. It's, you know, it's the one downside really is that it's just not that sanitary.
They would still have to make a disposable single.
Yeah,
use.
Something.
If it's good enough for McCoy, it's good enough for me.
So you still have to do some kind of disposable contact things or you have to sterilize it or wipe it off between each use. So the idea of just going from one person to the next in a mass inoculation program, which is the idea behind it, didn't actually hold up because it's there's too much blowback.
Okay. Is there now an anti-hypo spray crop?
Anti-hypo spray, right. All right, let's go to number two. China has developed a handheld heat ray gun that is lethal at up to 60 meters. Pretty much everyone thinks this one is the fiction.
Oh, no.
And this one is the fiction.
Yay! All right.
Thank you, Brian.
Cut the audience.
China has developed a heat ray gun.
Ooh. But it's for food.
The U.S. has also developed a heat ray gun. It's not handheld.
Oh, is that the one that just makes you feel uncomfortable?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a crowd dispersal.
It doesn't kill you. It's a crowd dispersal weapon.
So I was right. Like, you're just standing there and go, oh, my God.
Yes, it's exactly right.
I've got to run. Yes. I feel like a chicken rondelet.
It's a crowd dispersal weapon. It's to make people feel uncomfortable so they'll leave the area.
Is it microwave-based? Or?
Yes, it's microwave-based, exactly. Yeah.
So it heats up, I've read about
it
this.
Heats up the water
skin.
Under,
yes, there you go. So it heats up the hypo spray that was just shot at you.
Is there shielding? It's microwave-based? Is that dangerous?
I don't know.
It's dangerous to me.
We're trying to develop it, but we're not safe.
Why does that massive microwave?
Have your Jiffy Pop handy, and it'll pop your popcorn.
Yeah, that's time. There's a reason there's a shielding in our microwave.
So the one I saw, the picture of one, I don't have it, but it's like it was a truck. You know, basically with a big dish, you know, and I guess they would bring it to a crowd and they would, you know, chase the people away. It makes the exact same noise as the ships in the Mars, Invaders from Mars.
They play the country song?
What?
Mars Attacks.
Not Mars Attacks, the actual other movie.
I was definitely thinking of Mars Attacks.
War of the Worlds.
I've heard of that.
War of the Worlds, thank you. Okay. The U.S. military, the U.S. military has developed an Iron Man type full body armor with internal monitors and heads up display is science. So, cool. You know, it's just like they're just finishing it now. This has been developed in the last, over the last few years.
Yeah, but what can it do?
This is the Talos system. Doesn't fly. But basically, it's whole body armor that's bulletproof. The animation that the military like shows, which who knows how accurate this is like a soldier sort of strolling into what looks like a Middle Eastern hovel. And I don't know why they chose that. And then and he's being sprayed with bullets which are bouncing off of him harmlessly while he stands there, taking all of it. But also it monitors his heart rate and his blood pressure and his temperature. So it's like there's some health monitoring so you could know how they're doing. And also they have a heads-up display. So there are some features which are very similar to an Iron Man type suit. It does make sense that we would head in that direction. Yeah. Like why send in 1,000 soldiers and have half of them get killed when you could send in 10 with $1 million armor and they all walk out, you know.
Oh, no. It's also cool that there's a heads-up display. Like, just improvement in comms, I think, is so important for the military. Yeah. So that's cool.
And it's cool. They could probably talk to each other in the suits, right?
You also keep in mind that, from what I've read, you've got an entire generation of young soldiers who grew up playing video games. Yeah. And so
totally
it makes sense to make it more video game-like.
Totally comfortable with that.
Is it mechanized? I mean, one of the big things is that you need some sort of mechanized suit because these guys, these poor guys are carrying like 100 pounds. Yeah, 100 pounds
Well, they have been working on those exoskeletons for a long time, so I think it's only a matter of time before.
All right, we have 4 seconds.
Drones and robots.
It's all about the battery. It's all about the battery.
3 seconds. Evan, give us the quote.
Let us think the unthinkable. Let us do the undoable. Let us prepare to grapple with the ineffable itself and see if we may not F it after all. Douglas Adams, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency.
Thank you all for joining me. Thank you all for coming to watch us. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGE Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.